Welcome to Pentagon Solutions on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Here's your host, Tom Temin.
Vendor past performance is a big factor in awarding federal contracts, or should be. It's a smart practice, and in the Defense Department, it's also a requirement. And that's why the DoD Inspector General looked at 56 Army contracts awarded by five Army contracting shops to see whether the Army was consistent in evaluating past performance. Joining me with results, Michael Rourke, the Assistant Inspector General for Contract Management and Payments. Michael, good to have you back.
All right, thanks for having me.
Reading the report, it looks like something arcane about reporting and submitting reports and timeliness, but is it really about making sure that you're getting the most out of vendors?
Yes, it is a very important tool, not just in the Department of Defense, but across the entire government. Performance assessment is critical because it is our main way of assessing how a contractor performs on a contract. And so this information is valuable in future procurements. Source selection officials take this information into consideration as to how contractors did in the past. And so it is a critical piece of information that source selection officials need to know when they consider future procurements as to how someone did in the past.
So tell us what you looked at and what the methodology was.
So this is the third in a series of audits that we've done on contractor past performance. And in the past, we did the Navy and the Air Force. And so in this audit, being the third in the series, we focused on the Army. And we looked at five Army commands, the National Guard Bureau, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers Engineering Support Center, Huntsville, Army Contracting Command, Aberdeen, Army Contracting Command, Redstone Arsenal, and Army Contracting Command, Warren. And so at those five contracting commands, we reviewed 56 PARs, or performance assessment reports, and the contracts that were associated with those PARs had a contract value of $1.5 billion.
So this is not small stuff we're talking about.
No, that's a significant amount of money, and obviously when you're talking about some of the contracts at those commands, those are critical services and support for the Army, both at the National Guard and Army Corps of Engineers and the active duty Army. And so those are pretty important contracts.
What happened on the past performance front in these awards?
So we found two primary problems with past performance at these five Army contracting commands. The first major challenge was that 21 of the 56 performance assessment reports were not prepared within the 120-day required timeline. The interesting thing about that was that the average number of days late was about 59 days after the 129-day period. The second problem that we found was that 52 of the 56 PARs had challenges. Specifically, some of the issues that we saw there were that they did not have sufficient written narratives in 44 cases to justify the ratings given. The ratings did not address all the required evaluation factors in 23 instances, and then in 15 cases, there were not sufficient descriptions of the contract purpose.
What we're talking about here is the performance of the contracts after they were awarded, the kind of follow-up monitoring, correct?
Correct. So the performance assessment reports are completed at the end of each year and at the end of the contract, and so a contract could have multiple assessment reports on it. It's very similar to a report card at the end of each academic year. It's pretty similar format to that. And so if they're not done on time and if they're not complete or if they are not descriptive, it limits the usefulness.
And just give us a quick idea of the types of contracts that were involved here.
Well, we use the term non-systems contracts to basically eliminate the acquisition of weapon systems because those are kind of a category unto themselves. And so we really looked at service contracts, IT contracts, operational support contracts, just so that we can get a flavor of the everyday critical contracts that we use in the Department of Defense, and in this case in the Army, to make sure that our forces are ready to carry out the missions they need to.
We're speaking with Michael Rourke, the Assistant Defense Inspector General for Contract Management and Payments. They were not filing these reports. Do you have an indication that they were doing the evaluations but not doing the paperwork? Or was possibly the evaluation and the monitoring of the contracts lax and therefore the reports didn't come in time?
It was a variety of factors. In 32 cases, we saw that there were no PARs to begin with. So in those cases, we had some interaction with the command. We tried to understand a little bit better as to why that occurred. And then during the audit, 11 instances occurred where they completed the PAR once they knew that we were carrying out the audit. So in the end, there was about 21 cases where there just was no part to begin with. If a part was created, then you run into some of the challenges that we discussed earlier, which is that they were late or that they did not have sufficient written descriptions to justify the rating. So there's really two different problems there.
And when these PARs, these reports are posted, presuming they're posted online somewhere, mm-hmm. are they available for other Army commands and other DOD commands to take a look at?
Yes, and that's one of the most important elements of the of past performance is that once the PARs are loaded into the CPAR system or the Contractor Performance Assessment Reporting System, that is kind of extracted into another database called the Past Performance Information Retrieval System, and then that enables not just Army officials or DOD officials, but everyone in the government to review those for source selection across the government, because you may have contractors competing for contracts outside of DOD, and so those source selection officials need access to that as well.
So in other words, information that could lead to a contract decision to avoid somebody really bad, or making sure that if past performance is part of the evaluation gets a good rating, would be absent. That data wouldn't be available to some other contracting official.
Yes, the whole purpose of the past performance system is to ensure that current, complete, and accurate information is provided to source selection officials in whatever department they're in.
And so what did the Army tell you about this? Did they agree with your recommendations that they need a better process here?
Yes, we made recommendations to each of the Army commands that we visited, and we primarily provided two recommendations, which is to improve training and improve awareness of the requirements for assessors so that they can ensure that the past performance ratings are done. And then the second thing that we recommended was that Army commands needed to improve procedures for both reviewing reports and ensuring that reports are completed. And the Army commands that we visited responded pretty proactively with recommended changes, and we're in the process right now of getting their feedback to the final report. And so we anticipate that over the next few weeks we'll receive their corrective actions. In the report, the commands responded favorably. However, they did leave out a few details, and so we're following up with them to kind of complete the record there and ensure that there's a plan moving forward.
In general, who is it that is supposed to actually look at contractor performance after award? Is it the contracting officer? Is it the program owner? Is it the contracting officer's representative?
All those officials have a significant role in evaluating past performance. On the contracting side, the contracting officer ultimately is responsible for ensuring that the past performance is evaluated, but also program officials, as the folks who are receiving the service or receiving the product, obviously have a very big role in determining whether or not cost and technical qualities and timeliness were met. And so they obviously play a very big role in assessing how well the contractor performed.
And do you think it's possible for the Army to maybe re-engineer the process to make it easier to gather the information and file it? And perhaps that would improve timeliness and completeness.
Yes, we recommended to the Army several procedural best practices that could be implemented to improve their procedures. And in the report, we identified a few instances where the Army actually came back and had some good practices that they were starting to put in place. For example, the 120-day requirement to complete a PAR after a reporting period or after a contract has ended, that requires some back and forth with the contractor, specifically about 60 days where the contractor has time to respond to whatever rating the government has prepared. And so contracting commands need to kind of work backwards through that 120-day period to ensure that in that first 45 days or so, they are preparing the reports and then providing the contractors with their 60 days that they need to respond so that it can all be completed within 120 days.
Michael Rorick is the Assistant Defense Inspector General for Contract Management and Payments. Thanks so much for joining me.
Okay, thank you.
You can read more and share this interview with colleagues. Go to federalnewsradio.com/Federal Drive and click Share with Friends. I'm Tom Temin.
Pentagon Solutions will return after these messages.
It's just been one big nonstop party for the 100th anniversary of the national parks. Marvin Bond is the editor of Recreation News. He says this is the last chance you have to celebrate the Park Service centennial.
And that 100th birthday means a pretty good deal because August the 25th through the 28th, all National Park Service sites are admission free. Now, it's free to get in August the 25th to the 28th. Check out findyourpark.com for events at parks near you or at parks that might interest you. And you can find out more on page 6 of the August Recreation News.
Marvin, you're all about the deals this week. And you have a couple in North Carolina this time, right?
Yeah, you can check out the North Carolina section where we explore the Tar Heel State from the history and outdoor recreation on the Outer Banks to the military museums in Fayetteville, the antiquing in Wilson. It's a neat state to check out. If you haven't been down there in a while, find out more about it.
Marvin Bond is the editor of Recreation News.
Profile America, Monday, August 22nd. Two ordinary items used in many American households were created by New York City residents on this date in August. In 1865, the first liquid soap was patented by William Shepard. His formula flowed from mixing a pound of regular soap with 100 pounds of ammonia solution, then dissolving it in water to the consistency of molasses. And in 1939, Julian Seth Kahn received a patent for an apparatus for mixing a liquid with a gas, a spray can for whipped cream. Of course, aerosols didn't stop with whipped cream. Today in the U.S., soap and detergent manufacturing is a $21.5 billion a year business. The 173 metal can manufacturing establishments make over $15 billion in annual sales. You can find more facts about America from the U.S. Census Bureau online at census.gov.
With your Mayo Clinic Radio Health Minute, I'm Vivian Williams. For most people, varicose veins are just a cosmetic concern, but for some, varicose veins can cause aching and discomfort and occasionally lead to serious problems. But varicose veins aren't necessarily a bad thing.
People live on the average longer, maybe as much as 7 years longer when they have varicose veins than if they don't.
Dr. Tom Rook says varicose veins are caused by genetics and other factors like prolonged standing and obesity. Hormones are also a big factor. Puberty, pregnancy, and perimenopausal stages are times varicose veins form in women. Treatments can include stripping the veins, laser treatments, or a technique used to make the veins give up.
It's called sclerotherapy, and it involves injecting a caustic material into the veins.
This irritates the veins. They become inflamed, close down, and then scar up. For more information, talk to your doctor or visit mayoclinic.org.
Engineers are creating tiny nanoparticles that could have a big effect on acne. The root cause of acne is too much oil in pores of your skin. So Samir Mitragotri, a University of California engineer, has designed very tiny gold particles that can
go to the source of the problem, which usually is deep in the glands.
In what he says is a medical first, Mitragotri is using ultrasound to push the nanoparticles from the skin surface down to those oil-producing glands. Then
when you shine laser on them, they get pretty hot and they can deactivate the tissue in the surrounding area.
The effect is so localized that Mitragotri doesn't expect the side effects common with other treatments for severe acne. He says early clinical trials are promising. To find out more about this and other engineering innovation stories, please go to www.nae.edu/radio. That's nae.edu/radio. With the National Academy of Engineering, Randy Atkins, Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
You're listening to Pentagon Solutions on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Now here's your host, Tom Temin.
The DIUX, the Defense Department's so-called innovation unit in Silicon Valley, is expanding to Austin, Texas, and other places. That's right from Secretary Ash Carter. Does that mean he's dissing the companies right here in the D.C. region? I discussed this with local venture capitalist Jonathan Aberman, chairman of Amplifier Ventures.
He announced about 2 weeks ago, he was up in Boston, and as I've mentioned in another broadcast, the Pentagon had already decided to open up a material science consortium up there, which is the second consortium after the one they did around wearables in Silicon Valley. But what matters for our region, before we talk about the nation, what matters for our region is that in his remarks up in Boston, when Secretary Carter announced the expansion of the DIUX to Boston, he specifically called out the need for the Pentagon to be in other centers of innovation, as he described them. And the centers of innovation he identified were Boston and Silicon Valley and Austin, Texas, and Seattle, Washington. He did not mention Washington, D.C. in any way in his comments.
But in a sense, they're here already, right? I mean, they live here.
Well, that's the thing that I think many of us in the national security community are concerned about and should be, which is two things. First, DIUX is an acknowledgement that the existing infrastructure to provide innovations to national security agencies may not be providing them with everything they need. So if we in this region have an advantage, as we do, in supplying needs as currently described, a new activity that's looking in a different way may in fact be problematic. And which makes me think about the second point, which is if this effort in fact is designed to find innovation elsewhere, it's important to note again, it's the type of innovation they're looking for, meaning they're looking for innovations that are created in small, agile teams. What people describe as startups, but not necessarily. You know, a startup is just a group of people trying to pursue a business. It's the idea that many of the national security challenges that our nation faces are really only addressable through small innovative teams. And that's what DIUX is trying to fulfill. It's the blind spot they're trying to fill, which, by the way, Tandem NSI, you know, my initiative that we've been working on with the agencies, it's the same thing. It's trying to fix this blind spot. The question, Tom, for the DC region is whether this additional line of inquiry will ultimately result in agile groups, of which there are many in D.C., not getting their fair share of opportunities to be involved in this new trend. And the reason why I care about that is I do believe, having been involved in technology for a long time, that innovation often does come in small agile teams. So if we have an effort that's focused on agile teams generally, that's great for the nation. But if it doesn't focus on agile teams here, and all it focuses on is the incumbents, we're going to miss out on a growing and important technology trend.
I heard an interview, and I forget who it was with, actually, but it described the Army as something big and monolithic and powerful, but unable to see what's right underneath it at its feet level. If you extend that to the size of the Pentagon, all these innovative, agile teams, they're all over the place, really. In fact, I heard of one. We have an interview coming up with one that developed a kind of eye gear, a projectable eye gear that goes inside a diver's helmet, tethered divers, not a scuba diver, in the Navy, developed in the Navy, and they print it with 3D printing, and it solved a huge problem for divers working in dark, murky waters, which is most Navy diving operations, and it just happened locally, and they kept trying it, and the divers kept using it till they both decided, now we got it right.
See, that's exactly what I'm getting at. You know, look, it used to be, particularly after the Second World War, that we solved most of our national technology challenges through what people describe as big science. Tens of thousands of people coming together to solve a big problem, whether it was launching ICBMs over the North Pole, sending people to the moon, or curing cancer. That was the model of shared knowledge and the way big problems were solved. What we're now seeing is that the tools for solving problems are often now so widely available, we describe it in the technology industry as the democratization of innovation. The idea that two people and a bunch of Red Bull and a dog named Boo can come up with a new software company because the tools for creating software are so small. The same thing is true for drones now. You know, go on YouTube and search drones and you'll see unbelievable things being done by hobbyists and small teams.
Yeah, the Marines are playing with a drone, testing it, that's handheld. It looks like a toy it is a toy helicopter. But apparently they think they can do something tactical with it.
They can. Listen, terrorists are using drones as a way to track our troops now, the drones that they're able to buy online. This is a big trend. But there's another part of this, Tom, that's really important, which is what we have seen over the last 20 years is that the tools of innovation have become more available. Every large organization, not just the Department of Defense, is trying to figure out how to be more innovative. Whether you go and you look at Nordstrom, or you look at Capital One, or you look at the Pentagon, everywhere you look, there are innovation labs being set up in large organizations or work being done to help create small, agile teams to solve big problems. It's a trend that is meaningful because it works. You know, let's face it, large organizations exist to maintain the status quo, The problem with a large organization is it's not good at making rapid changes. So you can either throw up your hand and say, oh, well, I'll just accept the status quo, or you create small SWAT teams to get things done. That's what corporate America has been doing for the last 20 years, and now the Pentagon's doing it. They should. The Army should, the Navy should, the Air Force should, everybody should, no question. And the fact that DIUX exists, people have said to me, hey, Jonathan, is this something that's going to go away if the election turns a certain way? The answer is no, because this is now part of national security. All I'm saying is that this is a big national trend. I'm involved with it. I have many colleagues are involved with it. We're solving a big national security problem. Yay, we need to. But for those of us that make our living, for the listeners of your show, many of whom are involved in federal acquisition or serving the federal government, make no mistake, this is a problem you got to pay attention to.
We're speaking with Jonathan Apperman, chairman of Amplifier Ventures and of Tandem NSI. And so how can the local big companies that are in many ways unagile themselves maybe adapt to become more in line with what the Pentagon needs these days?
Well, I think that some of the larger government contractors are more actively embracing this agility concept than others. I'll call out Booz Allen, for example, for setting up their innovation lab downtown. I think they're doing some really interesting stuff. I've seen other government contractors doing similar type of things. I see different agencies looking to create an innovation labs. I think the answer, Tom, is it's ongoing. What's not happening as much as it should is we're not aggregating those activities into a common core where entrepreneurs and individuals who want to participate in it can go and find it in one place. Our region suffers. You know, we talk sometimes about how our regionalism suffers by having three jurisdictions. I think in a lot of ways our region suffers more from an entrepreneurial perspective because we have too many groups to claim to speak for entrepreneurs. We're a town of trade associations. And I'll tell you what I'm seeing more and more is a grassroots effort, particularly a part of cybersecurity entrepreneurs. They're trying to cut through the silos and create organically a cross-regional organized approach so that they can share the best leads and the best opportunities. I think that's a growing trend.
And I want to get back to DIUX because that tries to, in some ways, capitalize on that trend, if not here, elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
DIUX is a creature of the Pentagon policy people now and Ash Carter, but it doesn't really have a legal or congressional type of sponsor that I'm aware of. And so how can people that believe in it, say the career people, make sure that it survives to the next administration, regardless of who that might be?
Well, a lot of the work that I've done over the last 4 years with different people in the agencies lead me to believe that DIUX is the manifestation of a trend rather than a top-down programmatic approach. In other words, the desire to reach innovators is something that I have seen in many agencies that I've worked with over the last 4 years through my consulting business and Tandem. And those program managers and office directors are taking advantage of and using the FAR and OTAs in different innovative ways to solve problems that they have. And those problems aren't going to go away because whether it's making the government more efficient for our citizens or it's solving a national security challenge, there's a need for agility. So my message is whoever wins the election, it won't change the fundamentals that program managers and directors of programs need to find innovators. And now that the tools are available and have been shown to work, I think this is a trend that will continue whoever the president is.
Jonathan Apperman is chairman of Amplifier Ventures. Share this interview with colleagues. Go to federalnewsradio.com/Federal Drive and click Share with Friends. I'm Tom Temin.
You've been listening to Pentagon Solutions. Download this show or any of our weekly programs anytime at federalnewsradio.com. Search Pentagon Solutions.